Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Used to be high school was high school. Beyond different levels of math or English classes, everyone was basically getting the same education. That's changing now as a variety of specialized courses of study become options. Today, we're exploring the Evansville-Vandenberg School Corporation's Medical Professions Academy. We're joined by a student from the program. Austin Van Britsen is here. He's a sophomore. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
As well as Central High School Guidance Counselor Chris Gibson. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Micah. Thanks for having us.
And on the phone from his office at Vanderbilt University, Central High School alumnus and Vanderbilt's acting chair and professor of pharmacology, Joey Barnett. Welcome. Dr. Barnett? We hear a phone, but we don't know if he's there. We'll come back to Joey Barnett at Vanderbilt in a minute here. But I want to start with you, Austin Van Britsen. You're a sophomore now, as I mentioned. You are one of the first students to have joined the program, the Medical Professions Academy, when it started 2 years ago. You started as a freshman. And what led you to get involved in this?
I've always had an interest in medical related things, and my brother, he was into it too, and so we always talked about it, and he encouraged me to do it, and so I looked into it, and I really thought I'd enjoy the program, and I do now. So
you do it, so it panned out.
It did. It okay. Panned out very well.
Now you're going to be 16 in about a week.
A month.
Okay, yes. You're going to be 16 soon. Do you already know what you want to do with your life?
I have no idea. So, I've looked into different things. I play golf. I'd love to go somewhere for golf, but if I can't do that, then I have to have something to fall back on, but I haven't realized what that is yet.
A medical profession, possibly?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you're thinking that that could be a potential career path or maybe lead you into something in college?
Yes, and every day in MPA, we always realize a new path that we can go down, and you can think you want to be one thing one day, and then you want to go into a totally different career the next.
So it sounds like it's a chance to kind of experiment.
It is. It's. I know I've changed my mind. I've wanted to be a surgeon, and then I want a physical therapy, and it's just constant back and forth.
I imagine you must be getting exposed to a lot of different ideas.
Oh, yes, yes.
What stands out to you?
We've done job shadows at the hospital, and I went to, and I mean, even the medical. Like you think hospitals, and I even did maintenance, which is still medical. They have to keep up the hospital, like keep everything clean. And I thought that was amazing because just what they do in the hospital. You don't think about it, but it's crazy. And I mean, I thought about that kind of career too.
Interesting. Is Joey Barnett, are you on the phone now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
There's quite a bit of static.
Okay, well, you sound good on this end. So if you can understand me all right, I want to ask you, what Austin is saying is that medical professions obviously go beyond the obvious picks of doctor and nurse. You yourself are a scientist. You're not an MD, but you are also working within medical professions. How broad is this field? What are the options?
Well, I think as we're learning, the options are almost infinite. Clearly, in those engaged in healthcare delivery, there's physicians, nurses, several types of therapists, physical therapists, occupational therapists, clinical laboratory technicians and workers. I'm a biomedical research scientist. I'm trained as a pharmacologist who's engaged in design and development of drugs. And, for example, in my department, I can stand out in the hallway, and as I look up and down the hallway, I see everything from basic scientists who are doing the most basic chemistry and structural biology of drugs to those at one end of the hallway that are admitting patients for clinical studies. And so as a scientist, having that biomedical background so that we can understand how our basic science can impact healthcare and being able to have a shared vocabulary with those healthcare providers is essential. I would also say that as a person who runs a program that trains young scientists, is that more and more we see people with medical backgrounds filling really essential roles, not just in hospitals and academic medical centers, but being involved in formulating and conveying public policy. being involved in industry and pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies, which are important drivers in our economy. So I encourage students to think very broadly about careers in healthcare. And we have people who are MDs and PhDs or who are nurses with advanced training or PTs or OTs who are involved in everything from public policy to the most basic research to healthcare delivery.
So a growing field, if you've got the right credentials, you've got a job?
I'm sorry, you're too much static.
Is it a growing field where if you have the right credentials, you're likely to get employment, find a job?
Yes, yes, that is true. We continue to provide students with training who find opportunities in all of these areas. And again, even as we think not just as our need for healthcare providers grows, you know, we have an aging population, we have better and more specialized therapies, and we need more highly trained individuals to deliver those therapies. We also see that a large and growing segment of our economy is around biomedical research and taking these most basic science ideas and translating them into the clinic. And that continues to be a growth area.
So let me turn to you in the studio, Chris Gibson. You're a guidance counselor, and so you help, you've helped set up the MPA, and you're involved in encouraging kids to get involved with it. Who's a good fit for this?
Really, anyone who has identified that medical professions, and as Dr. Barnett said, that could mean anything, any number of health professions and career options. Anyone who has an interest in that, the beauty of Medical Professions Academy is that it allows that exploration in high school, because oftentimes the exploration comes in college or even with a college degree, you know, going out there in the job market and seeing what's available. And the Medical Professions Academy, I think, is just a great way to expose students to options that are there from their freshman year of high school, and also just, you know, being able to recognize the wide number of possibilities there are in healthcare. As you mentioned, not just, I mean, of course we need doctors and nurses and physical therapists, but to make sure that those options are known and that students can find a place in the medical field, even if they, you know, don't follow a traditional career, you know, they can find a place in the medical professions for their career.
So Austin was saying, you know, he's going to be 16 in a month. He doesn't know yet what he wants to be when he grows up, so to speak. But he's not locked into anything here, and it wouldn't be if he decides after 4 years of doing this and goes on to college and wants to major in, you know, interpretive dance,
right.
Nothing lost.
Exactly, because through the Medical Professions Academy, students do earn, they meet the criteria for a high school diploma, and we also have built the program such that students can still earn an academic honors diploma and a technical honors diploma through the state of Indiana. And the timing of the classes is pretty compact because we do have, it's a half-day program, and so we do have quite a few electives that speak to the medical professions. But at the same time, it's still a sound high school education that will allow them to go on to college and pursue anything, any career option that they may have. And it's valuable in the fact that it can expose students to careers, but it can also serve a valuable purpose if they decide, I don't want to go into medicine. Then, you know, it's an eye-opener early on so that they can kind of cross that off their list and move on to a different spot. Of course, we're hoping to generate interest in medical professions, but it does serve that purpose.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, that's very valuable knowing what you don't like.
Exactly.
I mean, it can be just as valuable. And it's, of course, much less costly than spending, say, 2 years of your undergrad doing pre-med and realizing, no, this isn't for me.
Right. And hopefully this just gives an earlier look to see, you know, is this a right fit for me? And if it's not, maybe I can look at something else even later in high school or, you know, into undergraduate study.
This is one of a number of specialized programs in the EVSC. Are we eventually going to see every student doing some sort of specialized program in high school, or does this remain a bit of an outlier?
I think that trend is growing, certainly, and we're always looking for ways to make education relevant and, you know, to connect to students to what they're interested in. And so that's the value of these types of programs, is it does allow students to be immersed into, you know, more than just the typical high school day. It really does provide that relevant experience to them so that they can just see if this is something that they connect to.
Austin Van Britsen, I know that Chris Gibson would have a good answer for this, but I want to see what you think. I'm looking at your list of courses that you take, and you take things, as one would expect, like biomedical science or biology. But I see that last year you also had digital communications tools. You're taking English classes. You're taking computer applications. You're taking sociology next year. How does that all connect?
It all connects, surprisingly. Digital communications. And like the classes we had last year, like we would do a lab in like biomed, and we would go to digital communications and we learn how to do it on the computer. Like we learn computer programs, like this year in web design, how to set up an Excel, and that helps us create a spreadsheet for something that we're doing in HBS. So it all ties together. And like sociology and psychology, yeah, that's how we act with patients. It'll teach us to get good people skills with people, like, and how to act around people.
How about English classes?
English classes, we've read books over medical things. We've read Kathy Reich books, and we've had to do an experiment over those.
She's the Bones series, yes. authors, yeah.
And we have to do an experiment, or a project, excuse me, over, and it's all medical related, and we'll write papers over medical related topics.
You're taking weightlifting next year as part of this.
Yes, sir. That ties into our anatomy class. We actually have two classes next year that are combined. And so in anatomy, we'll learn about the different muscles, and then we'll go into the weight room and we'll learn how they work. And like if we're learning about biceps, we'll go over to the curling machine and we'll learn how they work. So it's pretty neat how everything ties together.
The EVSC's Medical Professions Academy is trending. We'll have more in a minute after a break. Stay with us.
This is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. Still ahead on the program, we will deconstruct the stuffed pepper. And then later on, we'll take a look back at the Tri-State's major economic stories from 2012 and to what's ahead in the new year. That's all trending today on 88.3 WNIN.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're discussing medical professions and education with Central High School guidance counselor Chris Gibson, Central High School sophomore Austin Van Britsen, who is in that school's Medical Professions Academy, and Vanderbilt University professor of pharmacology Joey Barnett. And I think we've solved the static issue now. Is that right?
Yes, much
okay,
better.
Much better. All right, so now I can really ask you some questions since you can understand me. Aside from your obvious connection of being an Evansville native and a Central High School graduate, and also a USI grad, tell me a bit about your connection and your interest in the Medical Professions Academy. Why you're a busy man? Why devote time to this?
Well, it's really quite simple. As a student at Central High School, one reason that I'm sitting in the chair that I'm sitting in is because that I had engaged teachers who were really willing to step outside of the box and put in extra time and efforts and see abilities in me and encourage them that I really didn't see in myself. So what I really want to do is support the efforts of the faculty at Central to do just that, to really do what they do best, encourage the students and help them discover their passions and give them the tools to follow those.
What does that mean, visiting with them, having them visit you?
Visit with them. We've had students come down and visit here at Vanderbilt, and that was really quite a bit of fun. They were able to spend some time in our clinical research center and collect some data on each other, including how things like blood pressure and heart rate change with posture. They were able to spend time in the BOD pod, which allowed them to measure their percentage of body fat. They got a tour of the medical center, were able to meet with me and see what goes on in my laboratory. So it was a fun day for them, and it was a fun day for me to be able to host them.
What do you think surprises students who visit you about the work that you do or about what medical professions can encompass?
Well, I think what surprises them is two things. I think one is the breadth of people that we have. I think there are many jobs that they have never really had experience in the medical profession. I mean, we've already talked about doctors and nurses, but they go to the clinical research center and you see highly specialized research nurses. That was maybe something that they hadn't really thought about, or research technicians in the laboratory. The second thing I think that often surprises people is that scientists, especially in science, we have this notion that we work together or work as individuals. And I think what they're really surprised to see is the types of teams and relationships that we have here, where we have people who can be from the most basic science possible to clinicians who are working together to really solve and understand a problem in human disease.
I want you to answer this from your perspective as a professor and somebody who deals with college and university students. As programs like this become more common, as Chris Gibson is suggesting they well could become, do you think that the student who enters your program at Vanderbilt, for instance, without this kind of high school background, will eventually be put at a disadvantage?
Well, I think that's interesting, because several years ago we might have said the same thing about college education. Clearly, it provides an advantage because the students have exposure and experience. And despite, you know, what we might think about standardized tests and GPAs, the best predictor of success in any area is success in an area. And if we see people who have been successful and people who have a demonstrated interest, that piques our interest in bringing them in and allowing them to join our program.
So does that mean if somebody who hasn't done that, they're not going to pique your interest as much?
Well, they have to have something else that is going to pique our interest, that they can convince us that they have a real commitment to the area. Because the types of training that we provide takes a lot of commitment. And if we see people who have been able to have the ability to commit to this type of program and be successful in it, that's an important piece of data for us. So I don't want to make it too strong that if you don't have such a program, you're not going to be successful, but it's a clear advantage.
Mm-hmm. So that's the view from the university level. Chris Gibson, what about your view from the high school level preparing kids to apply for college?
A program like this or any other interest academy will certainly pique the interest of colleges. And I do think that, and I agree with Dr. Barnett, that it does give students a leg up as they go into, looking at these types of programs, whether, whichever college or university they would choose. And I do think that, it's just a great opportunity for students to have full immersion in this, and as he mentioned as well, working with others, that synergy of working with other people. I think that's part of the beauty of the MPA program, is that there is the connection with English and there is the connection with digital communications and sociology and social sciences, to see that science isn't in isolation, but that scientists work together every day and have to be able to communicate, have to be able to be computer savvy and have those tools to be able to do their job every day. And this, I think, it's certainly is a science academy, but it also helps with those other skills of how to write a good research paper, how to communicate with others and it just gives an exposure to research, in high school, which is so valuable.
Well, I noticed you have in the program, I think, an equal number of science, business, and English teachers, which I guess I wasn't expecting.
We do. And that just shows the integration between, and as Austin had mentioned earlier, they're really, we work hard to build connections between the different disciplines to show that, with what we do in biology and in principles of biomedical science, then if the students are learning about cancer in biomed class, they're learning about cells and biology, then in English, they're going to write a research paper and use those skills and, of course, meet academic standards for that. But they may write a research paper about a certain cancer. And then in digital communications, they would make a public service announcement with SlideRocket or other digital tools to communicate information about the cancer. And so it's really, you know, it's never in isolation. It's all just working together and really making those connections across disciplines.
These are fast-changing fields. How do you keep the teachers up to abreast of what's happening and current?
That's a good part about our collaboration, is that teachers are able to talk with one another, and we have time dedicated for teachers to, you know, see what's going on in one class and in another class. And the biomedical curriculum is through Project Lead the Way, and there are yearly updates with that curriculum, and it keeps that content current and relevant.
I guess you've had no trouble selling this program. It's in its second year, but your numbers keep going up.
That's true. We have about 30 students in our sophomore program right now in our cohort. We have 50 students in our freshman cohort, and we just recently discussed the 90 applicants that are looking to be a part of the program next year. And so that growth, I hope, speaks well for the program, that things are going well and that we are seeing more interest in these types of academies.
But you can't fit all 90 applicants in the program. Are we now applying to go to applying to go to high school now?
Well, for this specific academy, yes, in a way. And we really want to make sure, of course, we'd love to welcome as many as we could. At the same time, there are students who need remediation and extra skill building with English and with math. And as much as we would love to be able to do that, really our focus is the medical field. And if students do need those extra skill building classes, then we feel that their home high school is probably better equipped to do that. But it is a good problem to have.
I want to give you a chance just to plug something. You've got the 23rd annual Deaconess EVSC Health Science Institute coming up this summer, and the application deadline is fast approaching.
It is. It's February 1st, and the Health Science Institute is a collaboration between the EVSC and Deaconess Hospital, and it's, again, a good opportunity for students to be able to see healthcare hands-on and firsthand and live like a healthcare professional lives for those 2 weeks.
All right, great. Well, we're out of time, but I want to say a big thanks to Chris Gibson, Central High School Guidance Counselor. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate
Austin Van Britsen is a sophomore in the Medical Professions Academy, and happy 16th birthday a little early, Austin, and continued good luck with your studies.
Thank you.
And on the phone, we had Vanderbilt University's acting chair and professor of pharmacology, Joey Barnett, himself a Central High School graduate. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend, and associate producer Tony Voss joins us now for the Mid-Show B segment.
That's right, Micah. And for this week, Scott Hutchison will be bringing us The Hungry Hoosier. And he has a look back at his history of style.
Like a lot of other people who were in their late teens or early 20s in the 1980s, I took on the affectation of a preppy. I really wasn't one. Not a single wall at my college was covered with ivy, and my pedigree was more middle-class mutt than blue-blood hound. I did, however, have the wardrobe. Turned-up collars, sweater vests, Sperry topsiders, and a different pair of starched khakis for each day of the week. Hollywood capitalized on the preppy era with a whole slew of mediocre, preppy-laced coming-of-age films. In one, 1984's Making the Grade, a line of dialogue became a mantra for my friends and me. One of the characters, explaining the finer points of preppy haberdashery, picks up three shirts. He first points to one with a polo player on it, next to the one that looked like the JCPenney house brand Hunt Club, which were sold at the time, and finally to one with an alligator, and utters this line, "Preppy come lately, preppy never, preppy forever." My friends and I would have never, ever been caught with a Hunt Club insignia on our shirts, and although I had a few polo garments in my wardrobe, I was an Izod man, falling firmly into the preppy forever category. Over the next three decades, I flirted with New Wave, with a pair of red parachute pants and an aqua blue shirt with senseless zippers in odd places. I tested the tepid waters of grunge, wearing flannel shirts, a goatee, and bangs that hung into my face. But for the most part, I stayed true to my preppy roots. Even today, you'll likely find me in khakis and a button-down collared shirt, although I'm not nearly as brand loyal as I was in my youth. I'm also usually not one to get caught up in the fads of the kitchen either. I'm pretty traditional, but will occasionally flirt with a trendy technique. I did not succumb, however, to the fusion cuisine fad. you know, making German egg rolls or Peking duck pizzas. One trend, however, that did catch my attention was deconstruction. That's separating the elements of a familiar food. Chef Graham Elliott Bowles of the Avenues restaurant at Chicago's Peninsula Hotel deconstructs the classic Caesar salad with painstaking preparation and artful presentation. The result is a cured Spanish anchovy perched on a ruffled quenelle quarter of baby romaine sitting on a crisp brioche Twinkie filled with luxurious Parmesan cream. You see all the elements of the familiar salad, but pulled apart and then put together in a new and interesting way. Now, my deconstructions are not nearly as highbrow as Chef Bowles. I tend to deconstruct a favorite dish like a Philly cheesesteak sandwich and then put it back together in the form of another favorite dish like pizza. The latest deconstruction to occur in my kitchen focused on the lowly stuffed pepper. Now, this hearty entree held a regular spot on the dinner menu of my youth, especially on cold winter evenings. Soup, of course, is another cold weather favorite that seems to warm both the body and soul. So I decided to come up with a stuffed pepper soup that has all the flavors of the original dish my mom used to make, but in the form of a soup. You make this recipe by first sautéing onions, green peppers, and garlic in a Dutch oven or a stock pot, and then browning some lean hamburger. Next, you add crushed tomatoes and simmer it for about 30 minutes. Some cooked rice is stirred in right before serving, and you can get the whole recipe on the website. After nearly 30 years of cooking, I'm a firm traditionalist. My salads look like salads. Occasionally, however, it's fun to venture into a foodie-come-lately territory like deconstruction without going too far. But don't expect any molecular gastronomy out of me. My science grades weren't that good.
Scott Hutchison works in economic and community development for Purdue University and writes about food, family, and community for newspapers, magazines, radio, and TV. The Hungry Hoosier is a production of WBAA in West Lafayette, and at the Trends Facebook page right now, you'll find Scott's recipe for stuffed pepper soup. Thanks, Micah.
Thank you, Tony. You're listening to The Trend, and we'll continue the deconstructionist theme as we break down some economic numbers here in this next segment. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Turns out what Charles Dickens wrote about the time of the French Revolution could also apply to the tri-state's economy over the past year. We're going to spend some time now reviewing the area's economy in 2012, and maybe that'll give us a sense of where things are headed in the new year. Susan Orr writes about business and the economy for the Evansville Courier and Press. And Susan, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks, Micah.
So let's start with what's newest, and that's the unemployment numbers came out, and they're up, they're down. I guess it depends on what you want to see.
Yeah, that's right. The monthly numbers came out this morning, and the December statewide unemployment figure is 8.2%. That's an improvement over a year ago in December 2011, but it's up slightly over November. So sort of a good news, bad news, I guess.
And this is sort of like the stock market, where some economists say this day-to-day looking at the Dow is not really useful. You know, you gain a point here, you lose a point there. How useful is really granular month-to-month information versus looking at sort of broader year-to-year?
I would say I'm not an economist, but economists that I've talked to say generally that trends are better to look at than month by month. One thing that was interesting in the state release is they said that they felt like one reason that the unemployment rate went up a little bit as opposed to November was that more people were actually looking for work, because the unemployment rate only counts you if you're actively looking for work. And so kind of in a converse way, that's could be a good sign if people are feeling more hopeful.
Right.
If you've quit work, if you need a job, you don't have a job. If you've quit looking, that probably signifies a certain level of hopelessness. So getting back in there and looking may make the numbers look worse, but it might be a hopeful sign. Some people read it that way.
Right. So lots of things going on. And sort of the same idea. You know, you wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago, right around the turn of the new year, looking back at the 2012 economy. And again, hard to draw definite, you know, an arrow in a definite direction. It kind of depended on what company you're looking at.
That's one thing that I've found as a business writer. You can talk about the economy and sort of the big picture level, but it really varies from company to company. Some companies had some very good news last year. Some companies had some very bad news, and there, you know, a lot of companies in the middle just sort of taking along. So those things all get taken into account. And
like Shoe Carnival is one interesting example where they had one of their quarters went down, you reported, but that was because they had done relative to a previous year where they had done so well that it's hard to maintain that level of performance.
That's
all
right.
Time.
That's right. It's just like anything else. You know, the better you do, the harder comparison it will be in years to come. Yeah, Shoe Carnival was one of the companies I would put on the list that had a good 2012. They expanded into two major new markets for them. They expanded into Dallas and also opened their first stores in Puerto Rico. So that was a big thing for them. They're definitely still in expansion mode. They've had good earnings. They announced a dividend on their stock for the very first time ever. So they had some real positive things happening there.
Speaking of going public, that was the big thing for Berry Plastics, becoming a publicly traded company.
That's right. I had heard that rumor for, gosh, probably since I've been on the business beat the last couple of years.
Really?
That was in the works, but it finally did happen this year. They went public in October, and so that was a big milestone for them.
And I guess is that usually something that bodes well for a company? I mean, we saw the Facebook IPO, you know, everybody was super excited about that, and then their stock prices plunged after a very messy opening.
Right, right. Well, that was probably the worst case scenario for how an IPO could go. Berry's, I think, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think it didn't maybe perform as well as they would like, but just the fact of being public kind of puts you in a different realm. It requires a lot more of the company publicly reporting. You know, you can't do anything significant at the company without announcing it to all your shareholders and potential investors. It kind of puts you on a more of a high profile status, I guess you'd say. So
sort of playing at a different level.
Right, right. And maybe gives you know, certain investors an opportunity, especially institutional investors, an opportunity to invest in your company where they would not have if it had been privately held.
And of course, an expansion announcement from them just this week.
That's right. That's right. This, and the thing that is interesting about this is that their expansion will be in the form of buying new equipment to produce a whole new product line, because of course they do product development here in Evansville too. And Jonathan Rich, the top executive at Berry, said that they are hoping that this first product that they launch will be the first in a family of related new products. So, yeah, potentially some pretty exciting news for them.
And a decent year also for Toyota.
Right, right. Yeah, they had a huge announcement. It's one of the biggest business announcements I can remember in terms of just numbers of people that were crowded into the Toyota Visitor Center. It was last February. They announced they were going to significantly expand their Highlander production, starting some hybrids and also starting to produce some market-specific models for different countries, such as, you know, a country that maybe had needed configuration for driving on the other side of the road, that sort of thing.
Right.
And so that was going to be 400 new jobs. And if memory serves, they've already started hiring for that, and the production will begin by the end of this year.
And that's an interesting story, because I know if we look back a few more years to when the recession really hit, there were shift layoffs or temporary halts in production at a few points, and questions about, you know, as gas prices were soaring, questions about producing SUVs, is that still a viable business model?
Right.
And here we have an expansion built around an SUV.
Right, right. Of course, you might argue that the hybrid is their answer to the higher gas prices, because that's a more fuel efficient model. And also you got to consider too that the U.S. is just one market for Toyota, and the picture may be entirely different for them in different parts of the world too.
So these global companies, you really have to, you can't just look at them, certainly not regionally or not even necessarily nationally, you're saying.
Right. I mean, people here may do it because they think of the local plant, but the company itself is definitely not doing that. One good example is Mead Johnson Nutrition. When you listen to their earnings calls every quarter, They are definitely taking an international approach because China in particular and South America and Asia in general are really growth markets for them, whereas the U.S. and European markets are not doing nearly as well, and it has to do with demographics and economics and that sort of thing. So, even though people may not remember that all the time, companies that have an international presence are definitely that's important to them.
Because typically we look at where they're located, we look at them in terms of how many jobs are they employing in my town.
That's right. That's right. And also sometimes just the type of jobs makes a difference. I know when Mead Johnson, they introduced a pediatric nutrition center where they were actually doing product research here. And I remember at the time Greg Wathen from the local economic developer was saying, well, that's important because anytime you have R&D, that solidifies your position within the company as a location.
We're talking about the 2012 economy, reviewing that and looking ahead to this year with Susan Orr from the Courier and Press. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Trend.
This is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Support today comes from Tin Man Brewing Company, offering Tin Man's latest handcrafted beer creations and year-round staples, along with the experience of the Tin Man Tasting Room. More information at 1430 West Franklin Street, Evansville, or on the web at tinmanbrewing.com. And from Evansville Day School, announcing the Junior Pre-K Roundup Saturday, March 2nd at 9 and 10 a.m. for children turning 3 by September 15th. Learn more about the day school's programs like global language, outdoor learning, and the arts. Reservation required through Karen Bales at 812-476-3039. Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life.
I'm Micah Schweitzer. This is The Trend, and we're talking with Susan Orr, who covers business at the Evansville Courier and Press. Susan, we've talked about lots of good things. Let's look at the dark side, because that's your point, really, is that 2012, the regional economy depends on who you're looking at. And so if we look, for instance, at Whirlpool, that, of course, has continued to be a problematic story.
Yeah, that's right. That's the story that has a lot of emotion for a lot of people, just because Whirlpool in its heyday in Evansville just employed so many people. Of course, they closed down their production line in 2010. But the thing that was offered at that time was, well, we'll still have our product development center. We're still going to have engineers working on developing products for the whole rest of the company. So we are still in town in a reduced way. But then last year they announced that they were going to be moving that work up to their Michigan headquarters. And so by the end of 2014, all of those jobs will be out of Evansville. So that's one example of news that's kind of on the other end of things.
And, you know, jobs, that's one part of it. But the other part of it is that giant vacant building. I guess there might be a couple of tenants in there, but it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of square feet, largely unutilized. And then there was this promise last year that this company, EarthCare, was going to come in and they were going to use a portion of it. And then that fell flat.
Right, right. Yeah, that was a kind of a high profile disappointment in the city of Evansville. I would say the city announced with great anticipation that I guess you'd call it a green energy startup. They had an idea for using natural gas transmission lines as a way to generate power. And the city was promising incentives. And as things went along, the deal just kind of fell apart. So,
And that happens, I guess.
Sometimes it does, yeah, especially when you're talking about startups. I mean, there's no guarantee in business ever, and even established companies. I mean, look at what happened with Integra in 2011. That was a company that had been around for, you know, more than 100 years, and things happened and it went down. So it can happen, but, you know, especially more so with startups, because there's just not a track record there.
So how much stock do you put into announcements? For instance, you had quoted Greg Wathen from the Southwestern Indiana Economic Development Coalition saying that there are 22 projects in the pipeline. you know, Earth Care at one point would have been in a number like that, and of course it didn't pan out. So right. are 22 projects gonna come here, gonna employ people?
No, and I don't think Greg would ever probably claim that either. In the pipeline just means in some stage of discussions, and some I'm sure are more advanced than others. Of course, people like Greg, they're limited into what they can say because they don't, you know, they can't say too much before a deal's done, and it's not done until it's done. So, yeah, I mean, it's an encouraging sign that there's that many projects in the works, but that number I'm sure changes day to day, and not every project has an equal chance of coming through, I would imagine.
And it's worth pointing out that last year, 2012, was a big year in terms of commitments from companies to the state of Indiana. We're looking at, I'm trying to find my numbers here, and they're not turning up. But there were major commitments from a number of companies statewide. I mean, that's not looking as much at this region, but that's statewide, right. It was certainly a good year.
That's right. And that was from the State Economic Development Agency. And I think their numbers, because they, you know, they could only release numbers relevant to what they were doing, but it was how many job commitments they had secured that involved state level incentives. And so as was pointed out in the story that I did, that doesn't nearly cover all the job creation, because there's companies out there quietly maybe adding 10 or 20 jobs at a time that just don't announce it, or, you know, they fly under the radar. It also includes only those numbers in specific only include state incentives. And one thing that came out in that story was that Warrick County had zero commitments, and that does not mean that nobody added jobs in Warrick County. It just meant that there were no state incentives attached to any job growth in that county. And depending on your persuasion, you might look at that as a good thing or a bad thing.
I see. So again, all in how you read the numbers and
that's
so forth.
Right.
And I did find these numbers finally sitting right in front of my face as it happens. 18 commitments in southwestern Indiana alone last year, which with the 27,000 jobs. I think that was the statewide number.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have that right
in front
of me.
I pulled that from the article, but yeah. What about, you know, when you look at you brought up banking a little bit. What about Springleaf and Vantiv, these financial services corporations that are in town here? A rocky year as well for them last year.
That's definitely true. I would say if I had to name the number one sort of trouble story of the year in the business world, I might have to say Springleaf. They had a series of big layoffs. They've just been not in a good financial position and have really been eliminating jobs in Evansville and around their footprint. And so they're still working to right the ship. And, you know, that's one of the things I'll be looking for in 2013 is what's to come of that situation, because it's, you know, clearly something will happen, and I don't know which way, and, you know, probably people at the company may still be working to figure that out too.
What else are you watching for in this new year?
I guess from my perspective, I tend to think of certain stories that I've done and which tend to focus on a certain company or a certain event, and sort of, you know, issue or episode by episode. I'll be interested to see, although I don't know if it will reveal itself this year, but the I-69 corridor that's open between here and Crane, and eventually the plans are to all the way to Indy. But you heard a lot of talk about, well, you know, this, we could develop a high-tech corridor and get more involved with back and forth from Crane and that sort of thing. So I don't know that type of thing is something that will come to fruition just in the next 12 months, but that'll be something interesting to see. Of course, the downtown hotel, a lot of people are eagerly anticipating what's to come with that. That's a little bit off my beat, but it's still something mm-hmm. that is business related.
You know, speaking of a tech corridor, you had written a piece on the tech sector here and that the numbers were growing in the tech sector, but that's partially because it's so small that if you add 5 jobs or 20 jobs, you have measurable growth.
Yeah, that's right. That's definitely right. Yeah, studies like that are always, you sort of have to read and see what they're saying and see what they're not saying. And a lot of studies are just so specific that, you know, you'd be cautious in reading too global of an interpretation into it. One thing that was pointed out to me when I wrote that story, again, I think this was Greg Wathen saying, you know, just because there's not maybe tons of dedicated tech industries in Evansville does not mean we don't have tech type jobs. I mean, you know, any number of companies may have high tech positions within them, even though you wouldn't think of it as a high tech company necessarily, like manufacturing, for instance.
And speaking of manufacturing, there's this whole trend of reshoring to watch now.
Yeah, that's another thing. I can't give you any specific examples of companies that are involved with that here, but kind of the general thought is that the reasons that companies went overseas may not be as attractive anymore. Wages may be increasing in some company. Sometimes you hear about violence and problems there. So maybe the U.S. is getting more attractive.
Susan Orr teaching us to take the numbers with a grain of salt. She's a staff writer at the Evansville Courier and Press, where she covers business and the economy. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. And if you're surfing the web and you're tired of lolcats and Marauder Shields jokes and things like that, then why not check out our Facebook page? Search for The Trend on Facebook. You'll find this week's Hungry Hoosier recipe and a whole lot more.
Support for WNIN comes from Morton Solar, a renewable energy solution provider for residential, commercial, governmental, and utility clients. Located in Evansville, Indiana, Morton Solar provides consultation, engineering and design, and installation for projects throughout the tri-state area. Learn more at mortonsolar.com or 812-402-0900.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and it's time to wrap things up with the Arts Notebook. Roger McBain is here from the Courier and Press. Say, Roger.
Good afternoon.
And, Roger, there is a common misconception that classical music is stuffy or uppity or just respectable, and who wants to be respectable? But the Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra is playing music that says otherwise.
You know, classical music can be pretty decadent and depraved, too. The Philharmonic's Classics Concert
the punk
Saturday.
Rock of the 1800s.
Yeah. their program Saturday night is called mostly Mozart, A Night in Vienna, but I suggested in my story it could be called An Evening of Philandry. It opens with the overture to The Marriage of Figaro, which it was an opera that, the play it was based on was banned in Europe, and they had to finagle around to get the opera put on. But it deals with basically Figaro, a servant, trying to scheme to keep his employer, a Spanish count, from claiming the feudal right of taking his taking Figaro's bride's virginity the night before the wedding. And there's all kinds of subterfuges and comic things involved, but it's a pretty terrible thing that the aristocracy didn't want to talk about. They're also doing selections from Don Giovanni, which is Italian for Don Juan, the legendary Spanish Lothario. And a consultant on that project was a real-life Casanova, the Casanova of legend.
Oh, wow.
That's going to be 7 p.m. Saturday in the Victory.
Okay, if you're looking for a date with your paramour, that might be just the thing to go to. Now, Mozart was a prolific composer, but here's a new program that ups the ante a bit. High school students take a play from blank page to fully staged performance in all of 24 hours.
Right. This is based on an idea where you do it 24 hours straight through. You pull an all-nighter on this. They're not going to do this with the students at Central High School. Civic Theater is going to work with all the high schools in the school corporation this year to do this. But they're doing it in two 12-hour shifts. They're going to conceive, write, rehearse, and stage a new play. It will play at 7 p.m. Sunday at Central High School. And they're going to be doing that at other schools later on. But it's all going to come together. But they're going to go walk in there 7 a.m. tomorrow with nothing and put up a show at 7 p.m. the next night.
That's all we know.
Yeah.
It's the time. Yeah. I guess the ticket price.
Yeah. $10.
Yeah. Now, reading your article on the Harlem Globetrotters, this sounds a bit like theater meets the world of sports.
Well, yeah. I talked to Fatima TNT Maddox, who was a star high school player in Colorado. She played in college at Temple, and she played pro for a couple years in Europe before joining the Globetrotters. She didn't even know that they let women in till she got the call to come out and audition for them. But it is real athletics. At the same time, there's a lot of fun out there. Confetti buckets, pantsing your opponents on the global select team that plays and always loses. They claim they try. And then they've got a new wrinkle in this, which is the changing rules. You can go online and vote on whether they should use two balls on the court at the same time, whether they should have double points, four-point shots, things like that. So it's going to be kind of wild and unpredictable.
Sounds like a good time. All right. Now, speaking of globetrotting, you can head over to the University of Evansville for an art exhibit that has an international flair.
They have a show called Global Experiences. It's in the Peterson Gallery right across the street from the college there, the university there. And this is images from three globetrotting artists from the area, paintings by Cedric Huestis, photographs by Jim McKinney, who has done a lot of traveling, and ceramics by David Rodenberg, who travels every year and relies on some of his old Army memories of being over in Korea as well.
Great. And over at the University of Southern Indiana, old movies have a new sheen.
Yeah, I've been going over there for years to the free movies on Friday nights in the Forum, and then they'll let you attend the screenings for their film classes as well. So they've always been 35mm film. They just switched over the break to a new digital system that Eric Braysmith, the teacher of those classes, tells me is fabulous. It's going to be just like downtown, he says, a cinematic experience with old film. Yeah. Is going to look as sharp as if it was first run.
Wow. And then finally, events this weekend honoring longtime Evansville Museum Director John Streetman. And I really like this quote that he had in your article where he talked about turning down positions in bigger cities.
And he's had offers to go other places over the 38 years that he's been in Evansville. But he said there was no reason to, because he believes it doesn't matter where you are, it's what you do where you are. And that's always been his attitude. We've brought shows, major shows, in from other places, but we've also mounted major shows out of Evansville with catalogs and videos and all sorts of things.
All right.
2 to 4 p.m. Sunday is going to be that reception. There's going to be music, tours, free planetarium shows, and speeches. The mayor's going to talk about John, and John will make some remarks as well. I think that will start at 2:30 in the museum.
Roger's articles are in the Evansville Courier and Press and at couriepress.com. Thanks a lot, Roger.
Thank you.
The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer there. Tony Voss is at the board and our associate producer. Our theme music was written by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and we'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.